Thank you. I have to admit that I made a big mistake. I wrote my paper before this conference started, and I discovered during the conference that many questions I had to you Estonian musicologists are merely rhetorical or already often discussed or maybe more or less a truism. So I have decided to toss my paper and to make something a little bit more informal. I hope you don't mind. Besides that, you will get from me nothing very systematic, but some very highly subjective and selective ideas about writing a music history of post-Soviet Estonia. I think I want to close the cycle to the very first paper we heard from the Lipkos in this conference. I mean, the history of Estonia and the history of Estonian music has to be written. It is written right in this moment. It's something highly exciting, I would like to say, because now for the very first time all these knowledge works, structures, actors on this scene can be evaluated without any hard ideological force in the background. I mean, there's one two-volume history of the Estonian music from the Soviet times, and as Ulrich Lippos wrote, this book will maybe become very funny for future generations, but it's in any event not to be quoted. So I will address to some selected problems, which I think are maybe giving for you, or maybe inspiring, or maybe you already know that. First, I would like to emphasize that I think, or according to my information, Estonia's national identity is shifting right in this moment. I will talk about that a little bit more. The second question, or second box of question I would like to open is about Estonia's place in music history. What ideas you have to place it in a larger, maybe international context. The third point, which I think is also very challenging, is that Estonia is a multi-ethnic entity, to say it that way, and has been multi-ethnic. And of course, that is a question how these different ethnic groups will have their right and how you can do them justice when writing their history. And fourth point and last point is just a selection of some political and social implications which are maybe especially interesting here in Estonia when writing in Estonian music history. Yeah, my first point. Let me start like this. In 2009, there was a campaign from the Estonian Tourism Agency Visit Estonia. And they placed a lot of advertisement in Stockholm and in the newspapers, and this was running like, the slogan was, Visit Estonia - a Nordic country. I was surprised when I saw it for the first time, not very surprised, but because I think there are some reasons, and these reasons are also named on the website of Visit Estonia. You can read on the website. I think something which is essential for nowadays Estonian identity. Estonia was occupied by the Soviets for decades, but Estonia sees itself as more influenced by Nordic tastes and traditions. - Scandinavia with a twist. This is a slogan which was also, I think, used in political contexts. And already, 1999, the foreign minister, Ilves, claimed Estonia has to be seen as a Nordic country. Estonia has applied to be a member of the Nordic Council, and yes, I think right now it's not a surprise maybe for an outsider that Estonia is moving westwards towards the European Union. That's absolutely comprehensible, but moving towards north is maybe a kind of surprise, and I think it's a challenge. And my question is, of course, if you write music history now, will you anticipate some maybe future events, this shifting process? Do you think that it will gain momentum or lose it maybe? Because the Nordic countries are not as much a unity as one maybe would think. First question. Let me address to the second point. If you will write, I've got a very provoking, typical Taruskin quotation here about otherness. It is something which he is arguing against, as you know. The mythographic attitude towards otherness is shared especially widely among Slavists, Russists, and post-Sovietologists. he's not very clear. I think he's not talking so much about the Baltic states, but merely about Central Asian post-Soviet states, nations. We have our special reason to condemn and to resist utopian romanticism, however novel and glamorous the packaging. What he wants to say, and what he is explaining to a large extent in his book, Defining Russian Musically, is that if a composer or a group of composers or a group of music is classified in some way with a national label, like the Russian composers, this niche, which, so to say, opens in the music market, can easily become a trap for a composer. And I think he has got absolutely a point with that. But how can you, so to say, define an Estonian music history without defining Estonia as something special, different from the rest? And I would say that, I mean that's quite a complicated question. Just to give you an example from your neighbor country, Finland, John Sibelius was very early, I think, canonized as a national composer. And that applied not only to his explicitly national compositions like Finlandia or other works for special occasions, but also to his symphonies, which are, according to Sibelius, I would say, at least the last ones, a contribution to the continental, especially German, Austrian tradition of symphony. And that way, not national at all. But nonetheless, he could not escape to be received in that way, either in his country and abroad. And that was even, I think, it's a fine example for, so to say, defining or self-exoticizing yourself, as the Finns did in the time of the early national movement. And yeah, then you have the problem to struggle with that in the future. And of course, I mean, there's also a question of canonization. If you have such strong figures in your canon, like Sibelius, the shadow is indeed very long. And until today, many composers, like Rautavaara, are still compared to Sibelius without having anything in common, really, with his music. I mean, that's the question of otherness, but what would be the alternative thing? I mean, you have already outlined that 17th century and before, Estonia was, of course, not existing as a sovereign state, but that there was a lot of exchange going on in the Baltic Sea area. I mean, here you have got a good occasion to use some kind of supranational approach. And the thing is that Estonian music history embraces definitely different traditions coming from the northern countries, from Central Europe, from Eastern Europe. To what extent, I mean, to what extent you want to maybe to have a look at these traces. Again, I would like to address to the example Sibelius. I mean, he was considered to be the Finnish composer par excellence, and in this cause, Russian features of his personality and his music have been neglected widely until very recently. Gennadon Goss has written a very, I think, nice and intelligent book about this issue, John Sibelius and the Awakening of Finland. The National Awakening of Finland, which was published 2 years ago. And there you can see how she tries to discover these hidden layers of Sibelius' Russianness, something that would have been impossible during the 20s, the 30s, and even after the Second World War, when Finland underwent, so to say, a strong nationalization of its own culture. Nowadays, after the opening of the Iron Curtain, it's possible for young Estonian composers to study abroad. And I mean, that opens the field even more, definitely more. And the question is also, how closed has Estonia really been during the Cold War? I mean, there's one anecdote told by Paul Hillier in his Pat biography, where he tells that it is well known that Pat, as a young child, listened a lot to Finnish radio and listened especially to Finnish symphonies. In what way there was an impact? I mean, Estonia got, I think, the regions close to the sea got quite good the broadcastings from Finland. And in this case, you have some kind of hidden or not well documented transmission or communication of knowledge, maybe music, whatever, transfer. And finally, today, of course, in the time of postmodernism, music is open also, not only to geographically different music, but also to stylistically or different music like pop, jazz, folk, and world music. So in this context, the question of the national component in the Estonian music becomes even more difficult to answer, I would say. Another thought which I would like to take up is, again, if you take a look to Finland, you can see Derek Fuster wrote quite interesting book, he's the ethnologist, Visions of Past Glory. In this book he describes how the Finns, so to say, looked for some national symbols in the past. They found some pictures, some icons, some music instruments in the archives. And this, as he claims, was quite by accident, so to say. They found some, for instance, there was a picture of two men hunting squirrels, and they have these typical Finn caps, and they use some kind of bow to shoot them. And both of this was thought to be absolutely Finnish, and in the folklore movement it was used widely, even though this picture shows, obviously, Swedes, maybe. So, as he claims, and of course the tradition of Kalevala singing, which was not really, or the runic singing, which was not existing in Finland at the time, but in other remote areas like Karelia. And also a lot of myths occurred in that time, because there was a picture where you could see two old men playing with each other on the kantele or whatever. And for that reason, there was the belief that runo singing was a thing of two persons, some kind of responsorial or canonic thing. And again, Derek Fuster claims that this is a misunderstanding, because this picture shows not two men making music together. I mean, that. So if you so to say, start to look for national symbols and so on, misunderstandings can occur easily. And they can have quite a strong impact on the culture or on the history evolving after it. So, again, and of course, his book is the story of how the Swedish upper class, so to say, was pushed into the background peu à peu, after the First and after the Second World War. Now the question, of course, is you have different groups, ethnic groups here in Estonia, which shaped the country. I mean, very early the Danes, the Swedes, the Germans. After the Second World War, the Swedes and Germans are not anymore playing any role here in the country. And still you have a large Russian minority, and as far as I can see, either you could say that the integration is not working well because they're reluctant to, or they don't have the chance to integrate. So the question is for me how you will consider this minority to be part of a Estonian music history / a history of music in Estonia. It is a highly sensitive issue. I'm fully aware of that, because the tensions between you and the Russians, even in Latvia, are quite strong. I know about that. And even the Germans did not really behave very well after First and after Second World War, during the Second World War here. So I think there are quite sensitive areas to be touched. If you want to be really objective, it's the question of the large audience will follow you in this question. And now finally I have some selected examples of the, I think, special political or particular political issues in this country. I mean, again, we have heard that many times the Estonians, like the Latvians, were in some way suppressed not only by the Russians but also by the German, so to say, by the German upper class. So they were in some way maybe excluded or whatever. And the question is how to approach this part of the history. Will you approach it from the perspective of the Estonians, that will say from the low social class, or will you take the German music, so to say, as one part of the Estonian history, as one integrated part, or as a separate part, as a kind of parallel culture? I mean, you have many possibilities to do it. Three maybe more concrete examples, which I would like to touch instead of a conclusion. The singing revolution, I mean, it is something so... what can I say, seductive for musicologists to let a new chapter in music history start with this singing revolution. It is something incredible to see it on the television, still it is. But I remember last year in Riga, or 2 years ago in Riga, there was a conference. It was, I think, the 42nd Baltic Musicological Conference. And there was a presentation of a sociologist, Sergei Kruk, who claimed this term singing revolution is not telling the truth in that way, that revolution implies that something is turned upside down. And according to his research, the singing revolution was a top-down phenomenon. That means the elite and large parts of the population prepared that. And if you take this part of the story for serious or for granted, then of course you have the problem that you cannot write a post-Soviet music history and start at zero at 1990, but you have a lot of actors on stage which have been there already before 1990. And in this question, you have, of course, the question, how did these people act in a dictatorship in this Soviet Union, which is also highly sensitive because many of these actors are still alive. I would say, let me take it a little bit polemically, you have two possibilities if you want to deal with this problem. One is to say everybody, to make it black and white, everybody who was living in the Soviet Union was political. I mean, that is still a way to do it. Timothy Jackson has attacked, for instance, very fiercely Jean Sibelius very recently by claiming that he did not resist actively to the Nazis, so he has to be seen as a support of the Nazis government. If you don't like this approach, which I could understand, then of course you have the other extreme. For instance, in Germany, where we have quite a lot of research about musicians and composers in the Nazi era. And here you can see more or less a quite individual approach. Every individual composer or musician is treated in its own way. And that gives you, of course, the instrumentary or the instruments at hand to make the thing quite differentiated. Just to give you some examples, you have a composer like Pfitzner really liked to become one of the chief composers of the Third Reich and really flirted with the Nazis, and not even flirted, offered himself. You have somebody like Richard Strauss, who had a very important position in the Reichsmusikkammer, but it's common sense as far as I see that he was not a totalitarian. He was not a leftist, of course, but he was not either a Nazi. He was maybe some old man who has lived almost his entire active life in a monarchy, and that was maybe the given form of government for him. And you have somebody like Hindemith in this inner immigration, even though that has been argued. You have somebody like Furtwängler, who stayed and claimed that he stayed to help his colleagues and to help the Germans by playing Beethoven, and thus, so to say, rising the torch of humanism in the middle of the inhuman society he was living in. And you have somebody like Anton von Weber, who surprisingly, even though his works were forbidden, sympathized with the Nazi ideology, obviously. So, I mean, if you go into this, you will surely discover some interesting things, and of course you will get a discussion which is not to end very soon. It's something you only get to preliminary halts. Another thing in this context, which I regard to be highly interesting, could be if 1919 was not, so to say, an overnight event, a single revolution, but something prepared, how did people prior to 1991 communicate about this issue? I mean, if there was, and I think there was, some kind of Estonian identity prior to 1991, in the head somewhere, it was surely nothing you could address openly or discuss openly, because, I mean, that was against the Soviet rule. And the question in that context is, of course, how did people communicate about this? Only one very particular example I've got. I got a record from a student concert in Greifswald prior to 89, and there was a very innocent song played, and there were only a few tones in the beginning, and the whole audience started laughing like hell, and immediately after that they continued. And I wonder, what is this? And somebody told me, yes, well, this few tones you heard, that's a children's song, Russian children's song about the Sputnik. And just the week before, a satirical magazine, Sputnik, was forbidden in GDR. So it was a kind of very subtextual conversation, which I would never have had any idea about. I don't know either the song or the whole situation about that. So if you want to go in that kind of research subtext, you have, of course, to hurry a little bit, because the actors of the 50s or 60s, I guess, get quite old right now, and if you want to get access to that knowledge. And the third problem, of course, there is quite a lot of there is some literature about Estonian music, and the question is, of course, is it just a document, or can you just use them as documents? I already mentioned this two-volume history, or is it merely can you maybe take some things also for serious and try to use it as a foundation for something new, or have you really to start at zero? I mean, there's a lot of raw material. If you look at the most recent publications, since 1980, there have been, for instance, three biographical lexica about musicians in Estonia. And just browse them, and it's impressive, the number, the sheer number of actors is quite impressive. Yeah, I just would like to stop here with my ideas. And again, I apologize for my absolutely improvised paper in this context, but I thank for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you for the interesting discussion. And now I must apologize before you really seriously, because after reading your abstract, that was a very conscious decision to put you into the end of the conference.
Okay.
Please forgive us.
Thank you. Thanks.
Because otherwise you would, after your paper, have heard what are the discussion among us going on.
So you're getting pedagogical goals, to say with me.
Well, let's go on together. But now, please, questions.
Actually, I have no question, but it is you who questioned.
Yes.
So we must answer your questions.
What?
In the course of time, but you have also.
Yes, exactly, I suppose.
So, yeah, I think this experience you can understand quite well.
Mm-hmm. I suppose. But I have to admit, I'm really an outsider. I mean, the session has the perfect name in my case. I really can just constate the facts. I cannot interpret it in any way.
What about the relation of German composers with the Stasi, let's say, and so on? Is there anything like that?
I think there's research going on, I think, but not, I think, in the same extent, like about the Third Reich. I think the Third Reich remains, I would say, the core area for such research.
And my last question, sorry, from you, it's about Arvo Pärt's Fourth Symphony.
Yes.
Which irritated music critics in German.
It did. It did, because Khodorkovsky is not regarded to be a quite sympathetic figure in Germany. So you can easily find in the web, for instance, some remarks like, why is he just taking this little bit obscure guy who got rich during this gold rush time in the 90s? I mean, he's not regarded to be a democratic or very, very charismatic person in Germany. And of course, I mean, Pärt has paused about 30 years of writing symphonies, so to dedicate such a work, such a large work to this person, of course, raises questions in Germany. I think if you take Pärt's background and really experience the Soviet oppression into consideration, then I think his idea becomes more clear. And it's not to be, he had also relativated his message, he did not want to glorify Khodorkovsky, but the human will to resist in general. And I think that's something he has experienced during his own years.
And I could add, it was just last July, there was a special concert in Strasbourg, and it was called Musica Libera. So if you don't remember, I can have it allowed, I can participate in this. And it was namely in honor of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and Arvo Pärt also participated there as the speaker, and one of his ideas, and other speakers that I first met with them. The principal idea is that Khodorkovsky's case is very much the same of the Soviet dissidents. Okay, so maybe could it be also the point that irritates German critics?
I think he's not seen as a dissident so much, especially maybe only some politically motivated people who, so to say, propagate a neoliberal or a liberal way of making economics. They see that he maybe as a kind of dissident. But I cannot see that, for instance, the German government is pushing Russia in any direction to release him or to make his life easier for him. I don't see that.
Can I just, I just wanted to pick up on the second point there about, you know, the musical world and the Soviet authority and so on. I mean, I don't know whether have any musicologists in Estonia been working in state security archive, this kind of thing? Because, I mean, I've encountered this a lot in the Balkan region, you know, for example, in Romania now. I mean, in a way, I would just sort of want there to be a little bit of a cautionary note about it, because it's been ludicrous what's happened down there. You know, once people have started going into the archives, and then they discover that this composer was informing here, there's been a kind of witch hunt going on. A lot of it actually coming from, it has to be said, more from journalists than scholars, but still, it really is, you know, people who any hint of a connection, you know, is being kind of seized upon, and I think that can get very unsavory, actually, and can get way out of perspective if you look at what people's motives really were in these occasions. So I'm just wondering if there's any work of that sort.
Well, some persons, for example, when Mimi Dietz worked on Dormis, he went through them. But, that's not only those archives. Even much simpler archives are quite interesting, like the Ministry of Culture and so. But very much knowledge is among people, so that that's not only, how those archives, particularly security archives, how papers were put together, what there are, well, so that's a really very complex question. And very much is done about present-day politicians, because every journalist wants to find out things, dirty things in their past, but not so much with intellectuals. They're mostly with writing monographs about some particular person. So that's in the future when reviewers start to write about the concentrate on the recent decades.
Can I just ask a second very short question?
Yeah.
It's just a detail. When you were talking about the view of Sibelius and the fact that you know, I can't remember the name of the author, but an author was kind of, as it were, rediscovering the Russian input to
Glenda Dongos. Yeah.
Okay, so you weren't just talking about Finnish views of Sibelius, because I mean, I can remember when I was even at school, let alone in it was very common to read this story about Sibelius and Russian music and so on.
Of course, I mean, if you talk about Tchaikovsky's impact on his first symphony or so. But she goes even further. So Glenda claims that his political ideas and political imaginations were quite Russian. He had had a tsar or emperor all his lifetime, and that was for him also the given form of a state, not a democracy. And besides that, there's one tour she re-emphasizes when, I think it was when Finland became independent, so he made a Russian tourney just to show something or to keep the context, I don't know, but you have really more, I think, more Russian influences than Sibelius, and then the Finnish historiography has seen or wanted to see.
By the way, there on this table, there is a great monograph by Leon Armet about Trans-Siberian symphonies. It was written during this sorry time, and it was dissertation defended in 68. And in this dissertation, Leon Armet wrote a lot of things about Sibelius' connection with Tchaikovsky, Borodin, and other Russian composers.
Mm.
We can bring up here really the idea that Finland, although we had a strong and important national culture, so we were also part of the Russian Empire, and so the connections with St. Petersburg were really lively. So there was really this feeling of being part of a larger community. And I said that the Finnish ideas on music, the agenda was in the 1920s, it was not anywhere near as nationalistic in music as it was in certain circles in Vienna and in Paris. But Finland was, the nationalism was not a political nationalism, it was a cultural nationalism, so I think that does make a difference. But so Sibelius himself, he of course he spoke quite a bit about his youth time interest in Tchaikovsky, but in general he was really very, very generous about his ideas, his appreciation of many Russian musicians, so it not even later during the time of the independence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to one of your last slides, when you brought out the one nation but several ethnic groups or influences, Estonians and Russians, I would like to underline the Finnish component in Estonian music and culture since or after 1965. Well, every Estonian family had their home Finne to communicate with, and really there was a huge impact of Finnish language, everything done in Finland, because that was somehow their window. So really, when you study what's going on in 1970s, 80s, and early 90s, the knowledge of Finnish language and the closeness and the easiness of communication, that's a huge impact. It was diminished later when it was natural that all the world. So.
Mm-hmm. I understand perfectly. Yeah. The same situation, I would say, then between GDR and Russia.
Yeah.
Also one. I would say one directed communication.
Well, thank you very much.